Hi, everyone. Welcome to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. I'm Langdon DeMint.
And I'm Julian Taylor.
And welcome to our podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. I'm joined today by my normal compadre with his shiny forehead and his even shinier cans today. Langdon, how's things, Langdon?
They're very good. How are things with you?
Yep, very good. I've had a few days off, which has been very nice. So I've been doing a bit of sightseeing in Scotland.
See, that's why you're not shiny. You're just relaxed. Things are. I'm in the heat of the battle. It's been spring break for 2 weeks.
I assumed you meant it was because he'd been to Scotland that he definitely was not.
Well, that too.
Pasty and wet.
He's finally gotten dry.
And for the more perceptive of you, you might have realised there was a third voice there. She's not bald. She's not a guy, but we're really pleased to welcome you, Crystal Danbury. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Crystal, tell us a bit about who you are. You're a podcaster extraordinaire as well, so it's great to have you on. But tell us a bit about your podcast. Tell us a bit about who you are and your background.
Amazing. So, Crystal Danbury. I have worked in the safety space for 21 years in August. And I love it. So one of the biggest things about me is that I absolutely adore my profession and would not and could not do anything else. Started in the nuclear industry, rail, logistics, transport, most recently a director of safety in the telecom space through COVID, and now working for a FTSE 100 retailer. I absolutely adore it. And then, as you mentioned, I've got a podcast with my awesome friend Elisa Lynch, which is called Speak. Very, very passionate. So most of it is around safety, but sometimes it's just on like the ethics in business, things that we are stumbling over, things that we're trying to chew on as professionals. We just ask people to come in and take what we call the speak seat and just bring their problem statement and we can just chew it up. So we love doing that together. And we do a couple of things. One of them is we don't edit it at all, which sometimes makes for pretty gritty viewing because it'll be every stumble of the word, every, oh God, should I have said that? All of your imposter syndrome is live on air. But there was one really important thing for me and Elisa, and that was when we started this about 18 months ago, there was no women doing podcasts, particularly in the safety space. And I think lots of the barriers to that can be around women particularly feeling like they have to be perfect. It has to be perfect. It has to be clipped. It has to be. And just like, actually, if we just show like the dirty conversation, the slip ups, and we make it really imperfect, they will see if we're doing it, they can absolutely go and do it. And since then, we've actually seen several female led podcasts pop up and some of them be unedited too, which makes us feel really proud. And then probably the last thing and the biggest part of my world is I am a mum to a little girl called Emily, who is soon to be 9. And you'll see an array of other children on my mantelpiece, which is all my very precious nieces and nephews, to which I'm called Auntie Christmas, proudly, because I give them too many things and squish them too much. So that's kind of me in a nutshell.
Cool.
Very nice.
I mean, we were very similar. We felt there was a lack of bald guys doing podcasts, which is why we both cracked on. But it's really great to hear. I love the sort of the approach of not editing as well. I think like we do most weeks, it's just a conversation. So it's warts and all. And I think yours, I think it's fair to say yours can be a bit more sweary than ours sometimes.
Oh, though. My goodness.
I have heard that. So, yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
I suppose one thing for me, Crystal, what do you really see is what prompted you to start the podcast in the first place? What do you see the value of the podcasts?
Oh, it's a good question, actually, because as a very specific route, myself and Elise were part of a online sort of safety community through COVID, a really, really epic one. It was then called Project Miletium. And we were asked by one of the guys who had their own podcast, Colin Nottage. So he has the Interesting Health and Safety podcast. And he asked me and Elisa to do a takeover for Women's International Day. And he was very lovely and said, I don't want you to tell me what it's about. I think pick a topic, like it's completely yours. And we came off the call and I said, I feel really uncomfortable because Women's International Day kind of gives me the ick. And then she said, oh God, same. And I said, well, why don't we do the podcast on that, on the fact that it gives us the ick? And so we did a full episode without telling Colin, because he said, don't tell us, on how uncomfortable it feels. But we go on this like long journey through the podcast of the most important people in the journey for equality and inclusion and equity is actually men. It's men that sit in most of the powerful seats. It's men that have most of the budgets to do recruitment. It's actually men. And the minute we create space and it doesn't become a man bashing, oh God, it's really unfair and, you know, men get more than we do. It's more like men are absolutely the gift here. And they absolutely can open those doors and they can create the inclusion. And so we had this lovely podcast. We did it. We felt quite empowered having a voice. And we came off for a few months and just thought, that's missing. And actually in the safety space particularly, there isn't many women to go and look at. And basically, like, where are the role models? Where are the super women, like, smashing it all so that other women can look on and be like, oh, if they can do it, I can do it. So it started from there. Massive passion for safety in both of our camps, both safety professionals. Took over a podcast for a day, all about the ick, and then thought, representation matters, so let's do it.
I love that. I think that's why we'll get on, because we kind of try and just be a bit contentious sometimes and not just go with the flow. Yeah. It's like having things like Health and Safety Day and Health and Safety Month, isn't it? And, well, what about the rest of the year?
Yeah. What about this, the movement in general? Not a flag for a moment. Yeah.
I think the reason this came about, obviously, other than listening to your podcast and thinking it'd be great to get you on, was from a LinkedIn post, and you were talking about simplifying things, and it just kind of really resonated with us in terms of that whole let's make safety easy. So I think it'd be good if we could start to unpick that a bit in terms of some of the sort of key things that you focused on, because you've worked for some pretty large businesses.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things that you've done around simplification to make a difference?
Amazing. So I am really, really passionate about simple safety. And I actually have a strapline here that my boss loves, and it is making safety as simple, making it as simple as possible to be as safe as possible. And there are two things in there. One is the acknowledgement that we've made it very complicated. And the other one is the clear statement, as safe as possible, right? Is a clear acknowledgement that risk exists. The minute you walk into the workplace or out of your house, it exists, and we have to be comfortable with that. And so one of the really big discussions that I have typically when forming a new team is, I don't think there's one safety team out there, especially one that's been stagnant for some years, that can say, do you think every single piece of your e-learning adds value, reduces harm, manages a risk? Do you think every process, policy, and procedure that you have adds value, reduces harm, or manages risk in any way? The majority of it is no. Right? When it comes down to that stuff, most of that stuff is about how do we cover our butts? It's already too late. If you're talking about covering your butt, the bad things happened and you've already lost. So I think one of the really big things for me is to say all the things, first of all, that we ask for as a safety team or a safety function, what are they? Where are they? And do they align really clearly with our risk profile? What sits outside that? Do we even need it? Right? Because if they're not managing a risk and they're not reducing harm, why is it here? And then my other really clear mission is, I think the definition of excellent safety in an organization is when you have somebody steering that ship that looks at two things. And one is professional excellence. It's what is excellent in safety? It's typically, am I hurting less people? Am I getting to the cause of harm and reducing it? And then what is excellent for my business? How does my business win? And your strategy as a safety professional should serve both of those things simultaneously. And if you just focus on those two things, it's amazing if you didn't say just what does that need to function? How do we need to get great safety? So how do we reduce harm? How do we win? So if you're a telecoms company, serve more homes as an example, right? And then you put everything around those things and say everything on the periphery, start for 10, they're not needed. And if they are, justify it. Tell me how it helps you. It starts a really contentious discussion internally about all the things that have made us feel safe, not necessarily be safe. And where I am now, at the very beginning, I did a time and motion study. Everyone hated me for it. And for 2 weeks, I made everybody write down the time they spent on what tasks. And I got everybody together in an auditorium. And I created an axis with time at the bottom and impact on safety of people at the side. And then made everybody plot it. And then drew a big cross through the middle and said everything that was high time, low impact was an automatic stop. Everything that was low time, high impact was an automatic stay. And then everything in the other quadrants was like, how do we make it more impactful or quicker? And the fractious nature of that conversation about there was things in the automatic stop category that were hurting people's feelings. Like, I've always done this part. How does it help? Yeah. And if it doesn't help, or my favorite one with my team, and they will all laugh if they hear this, if you wouldn't design this, if your organization was opening in 30 days and it wouldn't be your starter for 10, it doesn't need to be here. And if it does, justify it, right? In a big way. And those conversations alone bear such great fruit. Why are we doing this e-learn? Why do we have that policy? Why are we asking 50 million assurance questions when we can just go and visit once a month and just see how things are going? Like, where's the benefit? And typically everything that sits on the periphery of those discussions that doesn't add value, I will cull happily. And they're big discussions, but the things that stay, and this is how you get buy-in from your organization to do scary things. I'm serving your overall purpose and I'm saving our people from harm. There's nothing bad in this mission. There is just like, take a breath, walk forward.
I'm curious. And I love that. I love that thought. Honestly, I love it. I think it's very, you know, it tells where most organizations want to get to, right? Hopefully. I'm curious, how do you see it? And yeah, my past, I've worked large global organizations that were more proactive with health and safety for the most part. And then a lot of small that really they weren't. And anything that they were doing was very much, let's check the box for insurance and where that falls in from the risk perspective. How are you seeing some of that from your experience, from your past, when getting to the basics, when some of those organizations don't even really understand what is a basic?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Sorry, I know that was a curveball from what we've
spoken about. It's a beautiful question, because I think it's, I don't think it's wrong to say that organizations that I go into now, typically they're saying, we know something needs to change, but we don't know what, Crystal. Come and help. And the first things that I do is I ask for the basics, which are, or the outputs from the basics, which are, okay, great. Lovely to be here. Glad we want to do something different. Can I see an understanding of your most consistent root causes, your most consistent operations, task, or environments that cause the most levels of harm, where it goes really critically wrong? What were the routes through those events? Where, if let's just say an organization's been prosecuted in some way, what were the judge learnings? What were the judge's comments on that case, as an example? And what you're digging into, and I say this, and there's some people that I love in safety that I row about this with, but safety is not difficult, right, to explain. It is very difficult to execute. See the problem, understand it, mitigate, remove, or accept. It's just three steps, right? It's nothing more than that. And all I'm saying when I ask for that data or that insight is, have you seen the problem? And do you understand where it is and what it is? And have you mitigated, accept, or removed it? That's it. Typically, big organizations go, what do you mean? And why would I need to know this amount of information? And that in the first day, in the first hour, tells me where we are on our maturity scale. Because we can be doing fantastic proactive things on design. If the fundamentals of your operation are not understanding their harm or their risk and tackling it effectively, The basics just aren't there. So I see that prevalently in most massive organizations where you've got really big, and typically old school safety professionals are building the basics around basic compliance. It's too late. You hurt the person. If you're in court arguing about or negotiating on a civil claim, you already lost. And actually paying and making sure the person is right, because I'm the director of safety and insurance, right? So I also very much understand that insurance discussion. It's the right thing to make somebody whole if you have been, you know, if you haven't done the right thing. But it doesn't change anything. So your duty is in the basics. And when you build an organization safety team around compliance, what you say is, how easy is it for me to mitigate the reaction to the harm or the impact commercially or from a legal perspective from that harm? You're not tackling harm. You're tackling the response to harm. And that's not the same. And you will forever, and this is one of the conversations that I have, that's a really expensive way to exist as an organization. If you actually start to understand your roots and remove them, the event never happens. You don't need the lawyer. You don't need the case. You don't need the sick bay. You don't need the comp. You don't need any of it. So dial it right back to its basics. And people find that really uncomfortable because they have to acknowledge, oh, we don't have the basics.
Yeah. I always think this is really interesting, Crystal. And I mean, I still harp on about Heinrich's triangle, and it's 80 years old, and we still struggle to do it, don't we?
Yeah.
Which is those basics of actually, if we can get to the stuff at the bottom and start to get people to consciously think about that, you can start to make a difference very quickly. And it always makes me laugh because obviously we're a software organization, and the number of times we go and talk to organizations and the first thing they say to us is incident management. And I'm always kind of, it's chicken and egg, this, isn't it? Shouldn't we be talking risk management first? And we obviously have to manage incidents. And as you say, we have to understand the outputs of things that have happened, but risk management should be the focus and the priority.
And I think it opens up really amazing conversations. And if you just take like the rung one of safety, as I described it, like the identify harm or identify the risk,
yep.
What you end up having to have is a really gritty internal conversation about, so if we are not, let's say reporting is a really good example, right? One of the ways yep. that we see harm is it gets reported to us. Does yep. that happen effectively? Yes or no? Okay. Why? Now, the why yeah. is never the frontline person. And we're very quick to say, we have a process. You should have reported. Yeah. But did you design that process around the individual and the context of their day? No, then don't expect an improvement by just repeating and wagging a finger. And I love that the conversations around why come from breaking down those basic parts and talking about risk.
Yeah. And there's loads that you could sort of think about as well in terms of that why hasn't it been reported? And you can think about the simplification piece. So first of all, make it really, really easy for people to report things, make it a quick and easy process. But also it's that, I think the thing a lot of people forget is the personal value to me of reporting something. Why should I report something? What are your thoughts on that? Because I think that's something that's often missing. We talk about sort of, oh, it's a business priority. Well, I'm a cynical northern guy. I couldn't give a stuff about business priorities. So what motivates me to report something?
Yeah, I think this is very, very, very much around the communication and this purpose piece, like connecting to what great looks like in terms of safety. Yeah. And for me, one of the really big first parts of that conversation is saying how we got it wrong. We got this wrong. If we've designed a process wrong, and it's a safety process, which means it doesn't matter if I was in 6 months ago or 6 years ago, it's my process, right? I have to take accountability for that. And to basically communicate that you might see your report as one report, but actually that could form a picture of 50 people being hurt all over the organization. Or, and here's the other bit, when they report that second bit, do you understand it? And then do you remove, mitigate, or accept? You have to be able to demonstrate the worth of that report to the individual. So if you tell me something's gone wrong and you tell me something is dangerous at your site, the value you add to you and your environment right now is that will be gone, right? We are going to mitigate, remove, or accept. And if it is a really clear hazard, we'll remove it. So your report has tactical value for you, but also being really clear through one-to-one discussions, through being with the operation, doing the operation, to say this also could build up an incredible picture to say we have a problem in 50 locations and we're going to hurt potentially somebody more vulnerable than you, right? It could be somebody that's got a condition. It could be somebody, a member of the public. actually our responsibility is about creating a safe environment, not following the policy. I'm not interested in compliance to a policy. I'm interested in a great environment for you, for colleagues and for members of the public. And actually together we form that. That's not me, that's us.
And I think that was part of, I think about my experience, part of the challenge a lot of times when you work with some of those smaller organizations, nobody wanted people to get hurt, right? That's negligence isn't always that negative word that it sounds. It's just a lot of time the absence of understanding what they actually need to do. And I can recall going with an organization we'd been working for a little while, and they were just putting a lot of focus on compliance. And I had a relationship with the person, and finally, we'd become very candid. And I said, I just want to help you understand, when you're doing compliance, congratulations, you're now doing the bare minimum. I said, and I don't mean that negative, but what we're talking about is, how do we become to where that's commonplace and you're starting to implement and see things and learn from what's happening? I said, and that's, that's that connotation of being proactive, but that's just actually thinking about the organization and thinking about what's coming in. And something you just said, a lot of those smaller organizations, well, I'll say smaller, that a lot of them were very large, but maybe lower on the maturity. It was what happened when some outsider came onto the property and when the insurance got involved, when the general liability, that's when the game started changing. And I had a couple of years doing risk services for an insurance company. And that was, what happens with the employee? Hey, we want to make sure they're mitigated, but we had a patron come on site and trip when they came in and broke their shoulder. That's a big issue. And trying to figure out how you navigate both of those, that was always a challenge, to help them understand the importance of how they're really integrated together, albeit different, they're parallel running together.
Yeah, I can see that.
You said something earlier, Crystal, that really kind of piqued my interest, because it's kind of aligns a lot with something that we talk about a lot here, which is, and I think it's, I was going to talk to you about, if you're in a large organization, how do you get leadership doing things in the right way? How do you engage with leadership? And you talked about this, the business impact of safety. And I think this is a really critical thing for safety professionals to take on board, because I think you've got this part of the role has got to be as an influencer, and influencing isn't just down, it's up as well, so that we can get leadership doing the right thing. So talk to me a bit more about that sort of business impact piece, because I think that's really interesting.
So I tend to do an exercise called the true cost of harm. I'm presenting on this in Berlin actually next in May. One of the most uncomfortable things you can do with a safety team is pull together the level of loss an organization sees from your harm profile now and from safety as it's set up now. So you can do one of two things. You can look at the true cost of harm or the true cost of safety, which also includes, this is what it costs to run your team, to run your systems, to do all the things. The true cost of harm is the most important for me. And then if you're really, really brave and you've looked at all of your sick pay, all of your absence, all of your claims, all of your everything, and then you apply your margin, that's fairly terrifying for a board to be like, okay, that you have to make this just to pay for safety in the now. And if we feel like that's good, and here's the really respectful part of this, is I'm not going into an organization, and no safety professional should go in and think that they're going to go and speak to a board and say, this is garbage, and expect any buy-in, right? Is we're coming from a fresh plane, and we can say, where are we now? Where are we now? Is this is the level of loss that we see from safety as it is now. And we know that we can build on this, we can reduce loss, and we can be a real commercial game changer for you, because I don't want to see waste. So I think for me, the influencing part comes from not being arrogant.
Not being the safety cop.
Like, why are we going in? Why would we ever go into board? And you think about how long board meetings are, think about how long those guys have sat there, the critical decisions they've had to make. Every single person walks in that room with a clear ROI. I'd like to buy these. it will cost this and it gives us this in terms of like custom revenue, whatever, right? Clear ROI. We're the only ones that walk in and say you can't put a price on safety.
How many times have you heard that?
Jesus, yeah. What do you mean? Yeah. Of course you can.
Yeah.
This is the price, yeah. Right? Is it true cost of harm? And yeah. Let me build you a really good, solid ROI. I'm going to change A, B, and C. It's going to take this much investment. Your true cost of harm is this. Your ROI will be 18 months' time and then generative from there on, right? Why would we think we are arrogant? Why would we as a profession act arrogantly and think we're the only people to walk in a board of like 50 people and they have to change their language for us? That's not right. Our job is to position ourselves as absolute business critical infrastructure and to go in and have a business critical discussion that is the same as everybody else's. And I think that's probably the most crucial is everyone else has an ROI, so should we. And I suppose the other thing is we also expect everybody to have a moral compass, right? To be like, oh my goodness, this is like heartbreaking to hear. We have to be really clear. Some people aren't going to feel that way. Some people aren't naturally empathetic. Who cares if they are output driven and you're being really clear on what your output is? They don't have to be in love with your moral story or even you, because everybody will be on your boat with a different function. Some people will be in the crow's nest, some will be rowing, some will be at the helm. It's cool. Everybody has a role to play. We don't have to have everybody thinking and feeling the way we do about safety. So I think once you drop that, go on.
No, I was going to say, and that's why I hate the term safety culture.
Yeah, I like because, it. Yeah.
I mean, that's, yeah. That
it's business culture, right? It's the culture of the organization. And a symptom of the business culture will be whether you care about your people or you do not. And that's a slightly separate point to the board level discussion about investment. Everyone's geared in a different way. How you treat your people in the round is indicative of your culture overall. 100% agree, Landon.
I think, you're just making me think of Simon Jones, who's been on the pod, who talks about being a safety salesperson. And that's what you've got to be, isn't it? You've got to be a salesperson and you've got to sell it. And I think it's a really important point you make, which is not everybody is motivated the same way. So it's really understanding with those board members, what's important to them. And actually tapping into that. And again, I mean, the big thing, we slam safety culture every opportunity we get, because the danger is we see it all the time. Safety teams working really hard to create a safety culture. Well, business culture will always overpower it. It'll always win out if it's at odds with it. So, I think that's a really important point to make. I suppose the other one, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, which is safety is always perceived as a cost, isn't it? And it's changing that perception to understand in our organization, actually, how does safety start to pay for
to
us?
To generate.
So, to generate, yeah.
I think that's, you often see it, and I've even mentored people that are like, oh, cost cuts will come again, they'll come for the safety team, etc.
Yeah.
And it's right back to, as you say, the commercial discussion is, this is what your true cost of harm is now. This is what the true cost of safety is. You're investing X, you're getting Y. If you want less X, you're going to get more Y, which is the negative, by the way. And I think one of the things we forget to do is when people say you save 10% of the bottom line or you cut the head or whatever, is to have that discussion of, well, if you really understood your true cost of harm and you could align each person in your organization to tackling that, take away that person, take away that part of the budget, take away, and have a very good discussion with your board or your director or your head of whatever it is to say, this means we have less protection against this area of risk. We have less people looking at it. We can simplify. One of the things that I like to do is to say, if you take out this head, you'll save X amount of money. Why don't you let me go and make you a better business case? If you really want to tackle the cost base of the organization, if I commit to saving you more than what that head costs, are we happy?
Yep.
There's only one way to think outside the box, right? Is you remove the box. Let's not talk about people as a cost. Let's talk about our resource to tackle a problem, and let's have that discussion.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I'm kind of curious to that point also. So you work presently for a very large organization. With balancing the employees, the general population that run in their property, different aspects like that, what are you seeing is with some of these principles, some of your largest or most focused challenges that you're trying to continue managing from an employee health and safety and honestly, all levels?
Biggest challenges. So if I lift it up from even where I work now, I'd say the last three roles that I've had sort of hit these same challenges. One of them is the safety culture journey, which is so interesting that you guys hate it, because at the beginning of any forum where somebody says, can we do some safety culture work? I'm like, amen that somebody is asking for progression in this area when we're talking about values and behaviors. But I caveat the very first sentence of any of those sessions with, this is a symptom and part of our overall culture. So I completely agree with you. And I think it's probably one of the biggest challenges and toughest things to do is to know sometimes our discussions are going to start here. And I've actually designed a safety culture ladder to say these are typically the symptoms you see around ground zero. This is typically what you see at the top. And I think one is where you see very large organizations, anyone working for a massive FTSE 100, 250, et cetera, typically their operation is divided into big sections. So when you're trying to tackle operational safety or the way that our mindsets work around operations, it's there's subcultures within your cultures. That's super difficult. And then you have different people at the helms of a different part of your organization with different attitudes, values, and behaviors, and they will trickle down. They will attract the same behaviors, et cetera. So you end up having to have a really ambitious plan to try and bring that together in some sort of unity. So that's a struggle. And that's where my back to the basics of safety comes from, which is what's the business's version of excellence and what's safety's version of excellence. And let's not talk about your different parts of your operation. Let's not talk about support functions or not, but let's talk about how does each of us feed into business excellence and safety excellence. It's a different conversation. And typically you can bring some united threads through that, which is, if great safety starts with seeing the problem in my area, I don't really see the problem because of this. Well, in my area, I don't see the problem because of that. Cool. What can we do as a collective to bring that together if we have a joint vision that we have to see the problem? So it's tricky. It's slow. There are a lot of stakeholders. And I think probably that's the second biggest thing in big organizations in the round is the amount of stakeholders that you need buy-in to move. And then each of those stakeholders will have a separate budget line and a separate area of responsibility and a separate purpose. Bringing those all together is tricky. It's tricky. It's my life's work. But I think it's that challenge that I love, because I think the minute... what you really find as a commonality between all these different areas and all these subcultures is everyone thinks they're doing their best for their bit. But I have like three versions of looking. You can look down at your problem, you can look out at the problem, and you can look out and see who's fixing it widely. And I would say most areas of the organization look down at their problem. But when you look at safety or culture overall, everybody has to look up and everybody has to look out to really, really get some progression. So actually trying to formulate a bus that everybody gets on with a unified view of doing something different and together and better and bringing a joint purpose together. That's the tricky thing. And I think that will be a forever piece of work, because every time you step forward, there'll be somewhere else you can go. There'll be more progression to go and get, if that answers the question.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, we talk quite often about how do you eat an elephant. That's an analogy we love, which
grab
is
grab a knife and fork.
And it's one bite at a time, isn't it? And it's sounds like you've got an enormous elephant that you're trying to consume at the moment. If that doesn't sound too weird, I think the other thing I was going to sort of touch on there, and again, I'm interested in your thoughts, which is we hate safety culture, but actually, is safety a lever to drive a better culture?
Yeah,
overall,
I think that's where I am well and truly on that bus, and that is why when an operator, particularly one that I've really been struggling with, as an example, says, "Can we do some safety culture stuff?" It means there has been a shift, and actually, to go through all of the junior thoughts, watering the plant, getting to the point of picking up the phone, I will take that all day long and I will water that plant. And I don't mind how an organization has to look at it, see it, call it, because it means that you want to do something different in your everyday. That is culturally shifting. And I think one of the things that's on my mind as I say that out loud is one of the first things I do in an organization is I change the word safety. Don't say to people, we're not going to say safety anymore. Is I just say harm. I don't say safety, right? Because safety feels like the compliance view. We are supposed to provide safety for everybody and we'll do it in these 10 ways. Whereas actually our purpose is to reduce harm. And that's mental, physical, psychological, the lot, right? So I will just go in and I'll do my presentations and I will talk about the harm types, the harm locations, the harm impact, the true cost of harm. I will talk about harm. And then it's really amazing. Underneath that, I changed some statistics. I don't like to look at all the traditional statistics. It drives me bonkers. I think it's all garbage. But I've created a hierarchy of instances I like to look at. So fatalities is obvious. Life-changing injuries. So my own definition made up changes to mobility, ability, or bodily function. And then MRIs, major recoverable. So high traumatic events that you'll repair from, like broken arms. They will tell me what's going on in an organization and where that harm sits. And so life-changing injury is an LCI, right? And the last organization I went into a board meeting to deliver my standard presentation, tell them what was going on. And one of the board directors, who was a fairly toxic individual, said, I need to ask the question. It's like on the second slide, but have we changed anybody's life this month? Like, are you, and it was the language change from, you're not talking about riddles, right? We're not talking about it. Have I changed somebody's life today? And we're having an emotional conversation about our people suddenly. We're saying harm instead of safety. We're saying, have we had any major recoverable injuries and who did I hurt? We are changing the discussion from a compliance way of talking at board level to an emotional way of talking, and it's care driven. Have we changed somebody's life? Jesus. And then you can have a discussion about that. And I remember leaving the room and a lady tapping me on the shoulder at my last organization. And she said, and bear in mind, they've seen the stats that came before, 20-page document every single years. And I go in, it's 6 months in, and she taps me on the shoulder and she says, I can't believe we're still changing people's life in the 2020s. And I was like, we are. And that's what we're here to stop. And she was like, and you could see her mind was blown. That is a cultural shift. They will go into other meetings and talk about life-changing injuries and changing people's lives. They'll talk about harm. They're not going to talk about compliance. They're not going to talk about the checkbox. That trickles down. That is a cultural shift, a business shift that is led by allowing the heartbeat in your organization, the safety team that was once a drag on your bottom line, to create value. And it really rebrands the value of your people and your resource, right? Which is your biggest, best asset is the people in your organization. And we talk about them in riddle numbers. What? Don't talk nonsense. So, yeah.
I love that, Crystal, because it's a big beef of ours, again, is around the reporting that businesses do. Mm. And actually it reduces people to numbers, doesn't it?
Yes.
So it's not personal. They're just a number.
Yeah.
And actually it doesn't mean anything, does it? Even putting a name to something all of a sudden changes that that perception and that thought process in somebody's mind.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about this often as well, is the whole part of a cultural change for us is actually changing the culture about the things that you report, who you report to and how often you report to them. And because I think there's a danger, so many businesses get into a rut, don't they? So we report once a month to senior leadership and we report on the number of incidents, riddles and so on. Yeah. And if you just stop and think about that, then it's okay. If we do that, how often does senior leadership seriously think about safety or think about harm? Yeah. And it's once a month when you throw it at them at a board meeting. And again, one of the ways you can start to change a culture is just not overwhelming people with information, but just giving it them more frequently. So it becomes part of the daily, weekly conversation rather than a monthly conversation.
Yeah. And I think for me, creating an apex, and it depends what you're trying to do, solve or change, right? For me, talking to a board about fatalities, life-changing injuries and major recoverables, and I throw a couple of other things in there because it creates comfort. And it creates a feeling of value, and it's the thing that we will shift on from. But I'll put lost time injuries in there. So this is the level of loss that you're seeing as a result of this apex and everything that sits underneath it. And then some proactive measures around near-miss reporting or hazard reporting, for example. But it's also understanding the level of your audience and what you want them to fix. Because if you're going in talking about a life-changing injury, your board aren't going to make that go away. It's not their job. It's their job to say, what do you need? This sounds like a problem. Yeah. Crystal, what do you need from me in this room? Or who do you need what from in this room? Because you're coming to me with a problem. Your job in leading safety is to very, very clearly understand what needs to happen, communicate it, and take the resource and fix the problem. So if you want them to be going away looking at red and green arrows because RIDDLE, which is a compliance measure, by the way, it's not a harm measure. It's how did you fill in the form? How many times did you fill in the form to tell the regulator? The regulator doesn't have proactive resource or time to come out. So we're not engaging with the regulator. We are complying to the legislation, right? So you want to go away in there for them to be like, okay, we've had like a 2% uptick in riddles. That's annoying. Or do you want them to go away thinking, we had 17 major recoverables. That's like high trauma events, okay? And that sit with you. And that to formulate questions from your seniors to you to say, what are you doing? What my favorite thing is if someone picks up the phone livid, I was like, we need to change a thing. And I'm like, yes, we do. So it's my favorite.
You know, and for me, that's why I really, I love human organizational performance, focus on SIFs, serious injury fatalities, you know, because it's painting that picture of why it really matters to the organization. You're not going to be profitable if your quality is somehow impacted, if your people are impacted, because the numbers are going to be impacted by that. And I mean, it's an avalanche, right? And that's an excellent point you bring up, Crystal. I mean, it's painting the picture.
Yeah.
On that reporting side as well, the other thing that interests me, Crystal, is what's your sort of thoughts or views, or what do you do with your organization around leading indicators? Is that part of the mindset as well?
Yes. And I think this is probably back to one of Landon's questions about like, what are the really tricky bits? What are the barriers that you hit? It's a journey. And sometimes I think you can go in really, really early with the sexy stuff. And you can just lose people. I don't know what you're about. I don't understand what HOP is. Why are you talking to me about all this stuff?
Yep.
Actually, if you break it right down to see it, understand it, sort it, you can bring everybody on that journey. And naturally, I think it's really important to have an equal measure of push and pull. So I want to push the organization, but I also want them to be so hungry and informed and part of this journey that they can also pull on me and go, hey, I want more in this area. What about this problem? And I think sometimes we can stuff stuff right down their neck and it can leave no ability for them to feel like they're coming out to get it, which then means we're driving, not them. So leading indicators is absolutely important. And for me is a really good indicator of how typically a location is feeling. Actually, it's typically how I look at it. We have a hazard reporting and near miss reporting. If you split out by operational area, you can see, why is that area four times what this area is? What is it, cultural? Is it leadership? Is it mechanism? It allows me to really dig underneath. And then bringing people on the journey of we can be equally as rigorous with an investigation of something that almost happened to something that did, that's a real shift in mindset for some leaderships that are typically compliance driven, and are coming on a reporting journey, let alone a cultural one.
And it must be a real challenge when you think about an organization the size of the one that you work for, where you've got so many diverse locations. And actually, talk about leadership. Well, leadership kind of goes all the way down through an organization, doesn't it? And even that local leadership makes the difference between excellence and not excellence.
Every layer of leadership has an impact. And I think this is where, for every leader that you influence, regardless of the level, they'll employ somebody, they'll pull somebody in, or they'll have indirect labor. How they treat people and how they value people, it will promulgate through several veins in your organization, right? What actually happens at the top is they are major arteries, and actually how they treat and think about people will pull down in a very big way, and it will influence other big leaders. But those guys that are frontline, that are putting together on a rough day, that are there when it goes wrong, or there when you make a mistake, are there to say, we can report that. They provide the psychological safety in the moment. Yep. We provide the infrastructure to do the right thing, but it's absolutely local management that create the psychological safety to do the thing that we say they're safe to do.
And it is, I mean, it just sort of makes me think back to what you were talking about earlier, which is actually when we talk about how do we get people to report things, one of the absolute key things is making people feel safe to report, isn't it? That actually the big fist isn't going to come out if you report this thing. So it's having, I suppose, those mechanisms in place to say thanks for reporting it. And also then you talked about what's the value of what you've reported. So having those feedback loops to say, because you reported this, this is what's happened.
Well, I mean, we're very quick to say, aren't we, you didn't report. This didn't happen. You know, this thing happened, report. And I always think, well, what do they get out of it? Or what's the, if I am already strapped for time, what is the value I am adding or giving? And if you can't demonstrate either, then I am really, really busy. And actually, I had a wicked CEO once who started off a leadership forum by saying, the most important thing you need to understand, and we were all directors, right? Was the higher you are, the less real work you do. He said, never, ever forget you're not doing the real work, right? So if you know, Veronica or Fred or whatever doing the real work has no time, if you think you're busy, they've got no time. They need to really understand the value of that action. And one of those things is really demonstrating, this is the thing I fixed as a result, or the celebration and praise, actually, to say, thank you so much for that insight. This is what it helped with.
Brilliant. I'm just conscious of the time, but I suppose I've got one last question, and I think we've maybe touched on bits of this as we've gone through, but I think you've got in the region of 190,000 colleagues at the moment. First question is, do you know them all by name? Second question is to me, because that's, to me, one of the holy grails of safety is that true engagement with people across an organization. How on earth do you start to get there with that many colleagues?
Yeah. So I think at the moment it's 175,000 and 30 million customers a week as well. So people completely out of our control. And actually, I always, the last place I worked as well had, I think, nearly 40,000 employees that were all pretty much field members, right? Solo workers, field members. And it's the same problem everywhere, is how do you talk to everybody? And it's back to that leadership thing. It's back to the language you use. You can't reach everybody. And I think actually, maybe back again to Langdon's thing about those big barriers. One of the really, really massive barriers I didn't really know existed, because it's just a problem, isn't it? I've got all these people and I need to talk to them, and I'm one person or one team. When I worked at Openreach, they brought in Workplace by Facebook, which is basically just Facebook for work, and they allowed it to be free reign. And I basically did frequent videos on thank yous, big hits from having like great reports, hazards we'd removed, the statistics, difficult weeks, etc. The engagement from that authentic drop of information was wild. And so I think your comms mechanism internally, your comms team and your comms platform, any organization right now, if you're listening to this, especially if you're a CEO or board member and you're scratching your head, please, please go and look at your comms structure. How much space is there for safety? How much narrative is there in the open domain about safety and organic discussion? Because I would say that was probably the biggest impact in the quickest time that I had, which was like direct plug in to all these members of staff. In an organization where it's not quite as like workplace by Facebook is mammothly expensive and there are a million other platforms. For me, it is making sure the structure of your team is correct. And for me, I structure my team under risk profiles. So premises, transport, logistics, retail, etc. And then the people heading up those areas, I also make sure that they have ground contact, like who are your field agents? And are we really all holistically saying excellent business, excellent safety? This is like, what's your part? So I think bringing the synergy into your safety team is step one. I will spend an entire day every single year plugging my guys into the purpose of what we do so that when they go out, they understand exactly what they bring and what their parts of their organization bring to safety so that everybody is collectively having that discussion. Clear data, like really sharing the big wins and not massive ones, and then plugging into board in a very, very big way is really key. But it's a big job. I actually had a phone call with an organization recently, wonderful, couple of people plugged in from like the US and a lady that used to work in Hong Kong, etc. Major brand, right? How do we do great safety? What does that look like? And they were talking about the core skill set of a brilliant director or head of safety. And I said, well, for your organization, you're going to have on there the sector that you work in as a like a mandatory thing on your job profile. Should they were like, of course. I was like, incorrect. Safety is the same everywhere. Your biggest skill set that you need to acquire is an ability to influence at scale. Because telling 100 people why safety is good is one thing. Telling 100,000 is another. And you need somebody, your top skill set has to be ability to influence and inform at scale. And I think that's often sometimes missed when people are leveling up or employing people. They'll look at the sector they're in and say, it has to be this. That's garbage. What you really want to understand is I have 40,000, 50,000, 200,000 people who can talk to those people in a way that drives passion and energy and unity on a purpose. That's the core skill.
I think I've finally seen some value for TikTok. TikTok could even be a great tool, couldn't it, just for getting those messages out there?
Do you know what, I started to use TikTok and do free leadership advice for people that were just like struggling to get on in their career, particularly for things like grads. It's a powerful tool, and I will say I put something on there about poor performance is a really difficult, I believe it is a leader's absolute responsibility to manage poor performance so that the rest of the team aren't carrying weight they don't need to carry because work is hard enough. And I was having a discussion over the weekend with several girls about poor performance. I was like, well, there's just some really great, easy tips and ways to manage poor performance. So they all leave the house. We have this discussion all evening over wine. And I do a video and it's 3 minutes and I upload it and I thought nothing more about it. And I went to bed and I woke up and had 200,000 views and was going up 1,000 views a minute. And so canned it immediately to be like, I absolutely do not need this in the domain right now. And also with something at that scale, you need obviously like permissions and all that sort of stuff. But I think, TikTok is a really, really, really powerful tool. And I love it. I think it's fantastic. Bite-sized piece of information that are useful.
Yep. Brilliant. Crystal, it's been a fantastic conversation. I think we're going to have to get you back again because we've had some good time there and I think we could have carried on talking all night, but you've got to go pick your daughter up.
I have, yeah.
which is an absolute priority. So we will definitely get you back for another episode.
Thank you.
It's been great talking with you. I'm going to let my shiny-headed friend sign us off in his usual fashion.
Yeah. Well, Crystal, we do appreciate it. It's been very enlightening and coming from industry that I have as well, it's really enjoyable because I can hear a lot of similarities of of conversations that I had with the organizations also. So we do appreciate it very much. Look forward to speaking again soon. But for all you others out there, as you're listening in, as you're going about your daily activities, going into stores, walking around with family and friends and other work peers, we hope that you stay healthy, stay safe, and ultimately watch each other's back out there, everyone. Thank you. Hey everyone, really appreciate you tuning into this episode of Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. Please follow and subscribe to wherever you stream your favorite podcast or visit us at evotix.com.
And if you want to see how follically challenged we really are, come and check us out on YouTube. If you've got value from the podcast, please go to Apple Podcasts. And in the review section of this podcast, if you could leave us a review or a rating, that would be great.
And as always, everyone, while you're going about your days and about your normal lives, stay safe out there and watch each other's back.